Welcome to Mic Drop Market Spaces today on Macro Trends. Just a reminder, before we begin, this material is presented solely for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not to be construed as a recommendation, solicitation, or an offer to buy or sell, long or short, any securities, commodities, or any related financial instruments. As always, please contact a licensed professional before making any investment or trading decisions. And with that, I will introduce our guests. We have Lakshman Akutan, who is co-founder of ECRI, the leading predictor of cycle turning points. For over 30 years, Lakshman has been studying the business cycle and working with clients. In 2004, he co-authored Beating the Business Cycle, How to Predict and Profit from Turning Points in the Economy. He met his mentor, Jeffrey H. Moore, at Columbia University in 1990, and after working for years together with another co-founder, the three left Columbia to start ECRI in 1996. He also serves on the Board of Governors for the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College. Next but not least, we have Jim Welsh. Jim Welsh has published a monthly investment letter since 1985 that focuses on Federal Reserve monetary policy, the economy, and financial markets. He's managed to build a mutual fund, worked for major wirehouses, and has been widely published in the financial media. Jim was Forward Fund's 5.5 billion macro technical strategist for a number of years and provides high quality economic and technical market analysis for advisors and investors as a guide to portfolio allocation and tactical portfolio changes. Welsh's micro tides models identify trend changes in the domestic and international equity markets, fixed income, currency, and the gold market. And with that, we'll start, since both of you are new to the panel, how we do this, I do rounds of questions, so nobody's just sitting there forever quiet, and we can make this as much of kind of a roundtable discussion as you want. So if you have a comment on somebody else's comment, you know, please feel free to jump in. And with that, I will start with Lakshman. So first, let's just start broadly, sort of, and this is kind of a big question, but what camp are you in, the soft landing, hard landing, or no landing camp?
Gosh, soft, hard, or no landing. Okay, so right now, I mean, things have shifted. We've been talking about a tug of war between the cyclical impulse to the downside and just, you know, a gargantuan excess fiscal spending, kind of a one-off non-cyclical push to the upside. And that tug of war has kept us from having a recession last year. And as we go into 2024, we see the tug of war continues, but some of the cyclical indicators on growth have started to firm and to improve. And it's not to say there isn't a whole bunch of cyclical difficulty under the hood, but in the aggregate, I've got to say that the risk of a hard landing in the short term from the growth indicators that we look at is lower. So, you know, I don't know if I want to say a soft landing, but I'd say that risk of a hard landing has been diminished quite a bit. The problem, because I got to leave you with a problem, the problem is that the separate inflation cycle looks to be turning up, setting up to turn up. And that is not really on anyone's bingo card. So that could make things difficult as the year progresses.
In your kind of recent interviews, you have kind of discussed this potential for a stealth recession, which you kind of alluded to. Why can't I talk today? Just now. So could you just elaborate on this a little bit more, what this means and what indicators you're watching closely to gauge its likelihood?
Sure. Well, to be clear, in 2022 and in 2023, leading indicators of growth, we're looking at different cycles. There's cycles in growth, separate cycles in inflation. So leading indicators of growth went down hard, and the window of vulnerability was wide open, where any kind of sizable shock could really chip us into recession. We even saw a couple quarters of negative GDP in 22, but we didn't have job losses. And you need to see job losses alongside contractions in production in order to have a hard landing, a so-called or a recession. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that are some, you know, I kind of do a catch-all in the tug of war, saying there are these pushbacks either from the excess fiscal spending, a lot of it, on the, you know, on the order of $7 trillion, I think. And then at the same time, a real constraining of the labor market. Under the Trump administration from 17 to 21, legal immigration kind of dried up. It stopped pretty much. And so we had a tightening of the labor market there. And then post-COVID, a lot of people didn't come back. That was even tighter labor market. And we combined that very, very tight labor market with a lot of stimulus. And so it was difficult. There was so much foam on the runway. It was difficult for the jobs to go negative. I think the cyclical impulse on the job market under the headlines has been very much to the downside. You know, temp jobs are contracting. You know, there's more part-time than full-time. There's the hours worked was lightening up quite a bit. So all those things you see managers pulling levers to lighten up their labor exposure, but they're reticent to fire people because of this like post-traumatic stress syndrome of not being able to hire them early in the year, you know, in the years before.
Excellent. And we will definitely come back to you. I want to go to Jim. Now, Jim, you did give me a report to share with our audience today. So I just published it on X and I put a link in the Nest. So if you guys want to open that to follow along, that would be great. And while people are doing that, Jim, you know, what are your thoughts on hard landing, no landing or soft landing?
Well, thank you for the invitation. Very glad to be joining you, Tracy. In 2022 and 2023, I did not think a recession was going to take hold for many reasons. And one of them actually was the yield curve, which many were pointing to like the sky was falling. Oh, my God, we have an inverted yield curve. And what I pointed out repeatedly, Tracy, was that the average yield curve inversion to the onset of a recession since the 1950s has been 19 months. So there's a very long lead time historically. And as Lakshman just pointed out, the fiscal stimulus suggested that the average or something longer was likely. In addition, consumers had excess savings. But if you take 19 months from July of 2022, when the curve inverted, that gets you January, February of 24. So to me, we're starting to get into that window where the inversion is likely to exert more downside pressure. Everyone knows about financial conditions. There's two types of financial conditions. The first gets, I think, more attention, and that is financial conditions based on financial markets. So they've eased significantly since last October because the S&P's rallied 25%. The dollar's down a little bit. Treasury yields on balance are down a little bit. The dollar's a little softer, yield spreads have narrowed. So those financial conditions have eased significantly. But the financial conditions on Main Street, what small businesses are paying to borrow money, what consumers are paying to have a credit card, personal loans, auto loans, those have remained tight. So the recent inflation data leading the Fed to say, okay, we're higher for longer, over time, that is, I believe, going to put more downward pressure on the economy. And I think as we get to mid-year and beyond, the linchpin of the bullish case has been the labor market. And if we look at a lot of forward indicators, like the establishment survey and the household survey, typically what has happened is near the end of a business cycle, you see more part-time jobs. Well, part of that is the definition that is used to calculate jobs. So if you're working and your employer cuts your hours from 28 to 20 and you can't pay your bills, you go get a second part-time job. In the establishment survey, that's counted as a new job. And over since February of 2023, the full-time jobs have actually declined as measured by the household survey, which doesn't include part-time jobs, while the establishment survey has increased, I think, about 900,000 jobs. So this is the exact same thing that happened prior to the 2001 recession, 2008 recession. And finally, things like the National Federation of Independent Business, small businesses account for half or more of all job creation. And in recent months, the percentage of firms planning to add employees in coming months has dropped fairly significantly. So when I look at these labor market indicators, Tracy, my take is we're going to see, as we get to mid-year and beyond, a slowdown and maybe a market slowdown in job growth. And I think that's what the markets aren't really fully expecting. So if it develops, it will also attend, obviously, a slowdown in economic growth. So to answer your question is, I think a recession is coming. It's just going to take some more time. Plus, the commercial real estate problem is a big deal. And as we get later this year and into next year, I think you've got significant problems that the banking system is going to have to deal with as loans come due and landlords walk away and more properties go on the market for sale.
Just back to the labor market really fast before we move on to the bond market. What do you find it a problem that most of this job growth we are seeing is literally coming from government jobs?
Yeah.
You know, and how long is that sustainable?
Well, as Lachman pointed out, there's an awful lot of government spending. But to your point, what really makes the U.S. economy go is growth in private jobs. I think it's about 150 million or so private jobs and less than 20 million. So the ratio of government jobs to private sector jobs is very significant. So I think your point is spot on that, yes, the government can keep hiring people, but if the private sector continues to cut back on hours and eventually get to a point where they, as Lachman pointed out, employers are very reluctant to let anybody go. But that's always been the case in every business cycle. It's more enhanced because of the difficulty employers had in the last 2 years to find good employees. But at some point in time, if sales start to slow meaningfully, they're being forced then to cut costs rather than just cut back on overtime, part-time jobs, temporary jobs, and they actually start to lay off people. That has been the historical pattern. And to me, the leading indicators of the labor market suggest that between mid-year and the end of the year, I think we're going to see a more pronounced pickup in more companies laying workers off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just keying off of that. Thank you, Jim. The thing that we watch is when there's a telltale sign of a kind of cyclical weakness is you can see when you look at needs versus wants. And so when needs are taking priority over wants, it's showing you that people are having to make some decisions. And you see it in the jobs market. Non-cyclical employment are things like healthcare or say education. And that is doing absolutely gangbusters, that employment. In 2023, it was running around 4%, which is well above where it typically is. And it continues to be strong. I think without that strength, we would have been in recession earlier. Let me just make that, it's just that simple. When you look at everything else, all the other jobs, non-farm jobs, excluding education and health, hasn't really been this low, the growth rates there, without a hard landing. That's the pattern in that data. And I think it really reveals that there was a very strong cyclical impulse down. That was not a mirage that happened earlier. And that was picked up by the leading indexes very, very clearly. And you saw the growth in the overall economy come down, decelerate very, very fast toward around, I don't know, two handle of some sort. And when I look at jobs and output and income and sales, and that kind of continues. We continue to tread water there for the time being, but that forward-looking data, much broader than simply interest rates. And we actually don't even use the yield curve in our leading indexes. But interest rates are, you know, the cost of money is important. And those forward-looking indicators for the time being, look, they're not saying forever, but they're saying on a cyclical basis for the next couple of quarters, that cyclical impulse is now firming a bit. So that has us going back to the original, to like soft landing, hard landing question. That's part of the reason why we're thinking there's more growth, less risk of a hard landing in the short term. When we look internationally, we see this global industrial upturn taking shape very clearly. And then separately on inflation, hey, it's firming. It's not easing. And so that's a, on the one hand, it sounds good. We're saying, well, there's no recession. But on the other hand, there's a whole bunch of things to contend with.
Yeah, and you actually have mentioned, you know, because everybody is talking about inflation right now, right? We've started to see it kind of rear its ugly head again over, you know, with uptick in CPI over the last 4 months. And obviously, you know, inflation is cyclical. And you mentioned something that the Fed's hoping it's different time. So it's different this time. So what are your forward indicators indicating on that?
On inflation, yeah, it's not different this time. It still is. It's a completely cyclical phenomenon. The narrative or the hope, I guess, is some sort of immaculate disinflation where without a hard landing, you come down toward the 2% target and hang out there, which allows for the idea that the Fed would be having multiple rate cuts this year. When we look at the inflation cycle itself, forgetting about that narrative, and we look at the inflation indicators, first we see you could look empirically or historically and see that in this century the international inflation cycles have been pretty well synchronized, and I'm talking about direction. Are they swinging up or down? You know, like North America, Europe, Asia, major emerging markets. And so we know that's a little, that's some information we have about the lay of the land on inflation cycles globally. Then we turn to our forward-looking future inflation gauges for these cycles. And all of them, except for the United States, future inflation gauges have been moving to the upside. First, the very long leading indicators moved up very decisively. And then sequentially, we look at them, the shorter leading future inflation gauges abroad have been moving up. And in the US, after having correctly called the downturn in inflation, those future inflation indicators have gone sideways for over a year. So they haven't turned up. But they stopped going down a long time ago. And so that's very consistent with whatever the story is around stickier or higher for longer that we've been hearing and seeing in the headlines and the debate. I'm quite wary. I'm watching very closely for any signs of the future inflation gauge in the U.S. moving to the upside, because that would more drastically reduce the prospect for rate cuts this year.
Tracy, if I could add one point, because I think it's instructive. When any of us are looking at CPI and the PCE, which is the Fed's more preferred inflation gauge, you have to look backwards in a sense to say, okay, well, let me preface this. All these indicators are a rate of change, a 12-month rate of change. So when the new number comes out, effectively what they're doing is subtracting whatever it was in March of 2023, for instance, and then adding whatever the current inflation rate for the month in March of 24. So what I've shown is if you look back at the PCE going back to 2023, the takeaway values in the first 6 months of the year are 35 basis points. So in other words, if current month-to-month PCE inflation is at 35 basis points or lower, inflation will trend sideways to actually decline. However, in the second half of 2023, the takeaway value of the monthly number is 17 basis points. So as we get towards the second half of this year, the month-to-month PCE inflation in 2024 from July to December is going to have to be below 17 basis points in order for the PCE to make further progress. So that to me is one of the reasons why, as Lakshman just mentioned about things kind of flatlining, to me, statistically looking forward, that implies that the hurdle rate for the PCE to really come down meaningfully is going to be hard, because you're going to have to see inflation month over month, less than 17 basis points. The first 2 months of this year at 30 basis points. So that's the hurdle, I think, for the second half. And Powell mentioned this kind of offhand comment in his press conference. And he mentioned about takeaway, or I think he said takeaway values. And no, I didn't see anybody else pick up on that, but it's like, okay, spot on, because those are the things I've been looking at in terms of inflation being sticky and potentially creeping upwards as 2024 progresses.
And that's in that report, you guys, that I put up in the Nest. I just published it for Jim. He was kind enough to give it to us. The PCE information is in that. And then turning to your reports, let's move on to the bond market. Because you talk about the bond market in that report, and you have a lovely chart on that. So let's talk about the 30-year trend since 1981 that broke in 2022. And can you elaborate on this a little bit more? What does this mean for markets?
Well, basically, if you go back to 1945 until 1981, there was a secular bear market in the Treasury bond market. Yields, I think, bottomed in 1945, less than 2%. You know, by September of 81, the 10-year got to 15.8. Then from September of 81, Treasury yields dropped and the 10-year got down to 55 basis points in March of 2020. So the point being is, for whatever reason, the Treasury market appears to have these very long secular bull phases and secular bear phases. And what's noted in that report is that looking at the 30-year Treasury bond, you can draw a trend line from the low in price in 1981 that it respected all the way up until 2022. And then there was a very decisive break. That suggests that the probability that the secular bull market in Treasury bonds is over and we've begun a new secular bear market. In addition, the Treasury bond decline from its high in price, and if you look at TLT, it was around 179, and it had declined to 82.42 last October. But it did it in a five-wave progression. And to me, from a chart analysis, that suggests that the major trend is for higher Treasury yields. In late December, that five-wave decline, or I should say last October, October 23rd, I issued a buy on TLT because you had five down. There were other technical considerations. I thought we would see a fairly significant rally. TLT rallied from under 83 to over 100. I think we're near another low, Tracy, that we're going to see Treasury yields come down. And again, this is predicated on the idea that the economy is going to start to show more slowing as we get to mid-year and beyond. And I think TLT can move up to 105, 109. But the implications, longer-term implication of an uptrend in Treasury yields, obviously is going to affect equity prices because they're valued. Valuations are built on the 10-year. And you think, well, what could possibly cause Treasury yields to keep going up? And supply. I think that's the biggest problem. The economy is growing at 3%, and last year the deficit was $1.7 trillion. If we have a recession, the deficit's going to jump to over $3 trillion. That's a lot of supply. Foreign demand has been creeping lower. And I just think that investors are going to be more demanding, if you will, so they don't choke on the paper to want to have higher yields. And then lastly, very quickly, in terms of inflation, you know, when oil prices ran up in the 1970s and then around 2008, what happened is there was an enormous increase in business investment by oil companies. And the net result is we saw a big increase in supply. We haven't seen a significant increase in business investment by energy companies to increase the supply of oil. That implies instead, you know, they've been buying back stock and kicking out dividends. That implies that, you know, down the next 5 to 10 years, oil supplies will be less than what they have historically been in response to higher prices. Well, that will support inflation. And then quickly, the globalization, which helped bring inflation down, is obviously in retreat. So those are some of the macro views of why I think inflation can trend up and why Treasury yields over the next 5, 10, 15 years or longer are likely to head higher.
And Lachman, what's your thought on the bond market right now?
Well, I guess, you know, I'd separate it into kind of cyclical the next couple of quarters. So anything I talk about cycle direction or what our forward-looking data is saying about cycles is looking out, you know, two or three quarters maybe. And structural, as Jim was saying, like 10 or more years, that's going to be a much longer term structural issue. So earlier when I was talking about inflation, which is a component, I guess, of long rates, inflation expectations there, on a cyclical basis, the forward-looking data, not backward-looking CPI data, but the forward-looking underlying drivers of the inflation cycle directionally, I think the risk is that they're moving to the upside. I think outside of the US, they're already moving to the upside. I think, you know, I'm just waiting to see some confirmation that they're doing it inside the US. And I'm not going to predict the predictors. I'll wait until the future inflation gauge goes up, but I'm on high alert there. Longer term, I absolutely agree with Jim. There are a whole host of issues, the supply issues we've talked about. Probably the other really, really big one is the shift from, say, last decade, like the post-GFC decade was all about globalization, the China price, just-in-time, imported disinflation around the goods sector. And that imported disinflation around the goods sector made it, quote unquote, difficult, you know, for the Fed to get inflation up, even though it was running, you had okay inflation in the services sector. Now, post COVID, you've gone from just in time to just in case supply needs, supply line needs, supply chain needs. And that is a great deal more expensive, certainly upfront. We're seeing that playing out, you know, and my gosh, we've all talked about supply chains a lot over the last few years. So people are very sensitive to that stuff. I think with the global industrial upturn in 2024 that is taking shape now, it puts a bid on the demand side for industrial commodities price inflation. And I think Jim was talking about the energy supply stuff, right? So in the 70s, the high prices resulted in a build out of supply. Now it seems after the last several years, for a whole host of reasons, the supply is down, right? You had a lot of ESG stuff and other things that have brought the supply down. Maybe the shale production isn't quite as juicy as it used to be. So there might be, you know, there's still stuff there, but over time that'll diminish and get harder to get to. So I think there's structurally a great deal of shift upward in the floor on inflation. So the lows in the inflation cycle may not be quite as low.
And how long do you think this takes to filter down to the economy where, you know, the Fed starts really paying attention? Because so far they're telling us how great the economy is. Yet we're talking here about some perhaps drag on the economy.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you want that or you want me to grab that?
Go ahead and jump in after.
Yeah. Well, look, I think if I'm telling you this, what I'd like to do is share the story of our leading indexes, right? So on the growth side, I'm not exactly sure of the narrative, but I think it's firming in the next quarter or two as we go later into this year. Part of the story may be the manufacturing sector getting some traction as part of the global industrial upturn. Now, the Fed absolutely wants the narrative to be that they have shifted their focus from tightening and from being higher for longer, and they've now focused on cutting. And then the only question is when. And as you know, at the end of last year, the narrative was kind of like many, many rate cuts, a handful or more in 2024. And that's been backed off quite a bit. The coincident inflation data that has come in, stickier, hotter, whatever you want to call it, has been, largely kind of talked away. Like, oh, it's a statistical thing here or there. Don't worry about it. But that is par for the course around cycle turning points. That's absolutely normal. It would be weird if it was otherwise. So I'm not surprised by that. I think if in this summer into the fall, those numbers don't go down, and I don't see how they will, that makes it very difficult for the Fed to hold its position. Look, they're very skilled jawboners, and so they'll keep doing it. But I think it makes it tougher to hold that position.
Well, I'll chip in with, at heart, I'm a contrarian. And when people were all, singing a recession in 2022 and last year, to me, it made me believe that that wasn't likely. And then, of course, things like employment growth was very, very strong in 2022 and in last year as well. So to me, the recent data potentially could be a head fake, where now everyone is certain. I think in November of 2022, only 10% of investment advisors thought we would avoid a recession. And now 65% believe that we don't have to worry about a recession. And as I said earlier, financial conditions on Main Street are tight. And that ultimately is, I think, going to call the tune. Lastly, at the beginning of this year, 6 rate cuts were factored in. Now we're down to 1.5. I'm in the view that I think we may get those 3 rate cuts, but it's not going to be because inflation's coming down. It's going to be because the economy slows more than expected. And, it's just, to me, a classic example. People like to believe markets discount the future. Always. I mean, I hear it every day when I listen to CNBC. And the irony, Tracy, I think, is that at tops and bottoms, markets are always wrong. Now, that's like heresy to people on Wall Street to say something like that. But in January of 2022, the S&P made a new all-time high. What was it discounting? A 25% decline? Or October 2007? Or March 2009? And what happens is, when you get a plurality of opinion around a certain narrative, for me, I start looking for cracks. What is going to cause that narrative to start to break down? Because that's when markets have their biggest moves, when people realize, oh my goodness, what I was expecting to happen isn't happening. And so, again, to me, we're at that, I think, an inflection point. And, you know, to me, there's a fair amount of technical signs that imply that this, you know, the stock market is vulnerable. So time will tell.
And since you brought up the stock market, you know, what are your thoughts on this current pullback in the broader markets? Is this part of a larger downturn, or is this just a much needed stealth correction? And kind of what are your indicators telling us or telling you with respect to the S&P, NASDAQ, and Russell?
Well, in late March, what I noted was that from the October 22 low, the S&P had completed three waves up. The initial went from around 3,500 to 4,600. Then there was a pullback to 4,100, then a rally to 5,200. My take was that we were going to see one more push above 5,261 to complete the rally from last October. And then we're, you know, the path is like there's two paths now. If one is bullish, there will be a pullback for wave four. And last July, August, and September, it was a 10% pullback. Followed by a new rally to a new all-time high. The bearish count is, yeah, three waves up from October 22, and we've hit a top. I'll note that every 17 years, the S&P has made an important top from 1939, 1956, 73, 90, 2007. Here we are in 2024. So to me, I'm on high alert for signs that the market may have more than just a 7 to 10% pullback in coming weeks. The other thing I put a lot of emphasis when they show up, key reversals. So on March 8th, every major indicator, or index, I should say, had a key reversal. Okay, what is a key reversal? It's when prices make a higher high than the day before, a lower low than the day before, and close down. And when these occur at the end of moves, Tracy, they're kind of like a sign of exhaustion. In other words, you just ran out of buyers. So there's been a key reversal on March 8th, a key reversal on April 4th, and then on April 15th. To me, what's cool is that NVIDIA has had a key reversal on those dates. The semiconductor index has had key reversals on those three dates. And so what that implied to me is those indexes are about to break down. They've been the, you know, the glue, if you will, of keeping people bullish. And if I'm right, and NVIDIA and the semiconductor index break down, we're likely to see some more weakness. My guess was a drop towards 5,100 was likely, then see a bounce. And then I think there's another decline coming that takes us into mid to late May. And at that point in time, we'll start to have, I think, more clues in terms of which path are we following. Are we following the bullish path of, yep, this is a wave four correction to be followed by a rally to new all-time highs, or if this is something more sinister? I just thought we were at a crossroads in late March that both patterns suggested the S&P was set up for a pullback. And so far, that's been playing out.
And what are your indicators telling us, if any, Lakshman, on the major indexes?
Well, they don't make market calls in that sense of where the market should be. But if you've got growth accelerating, that is helpful for share prices relative to wherever they were. So the one thing I would say is global industrial growth is set to accelerate. So I think that that's supportive of firms that have exposure there or that are tied to the global industrial growth cycle. And then separately, at least on the international front, there's an inflation cycle upturn. So I would look to things that would benefit from global inflation turning up. Now, if the problem here, the hesitation you hear in my voice, right, is that if the future inflation gauge turns up, I mean, watch out, because that means that can upset the apple cart. There's so many things that are predicated on the narrative of Fed rate cuts. Jim hit on a whole bunch of them, but like, you know, commercial real estate, I mean, they are praying that there's some rate cuts, right? I agree fully with the comment on Main Street. Okay. Delinquencies are way up. Bankruptcies are rising. Okay. These are not great signs. They're signs of strain at these higher for longer rates that we have. And so Main Street is hurting. Wage earners are having a tough time. If you are asset rich, if you've got a fortress balance sheet, hey, you're making some good interest rate return. You know, it's a very different world for you in that realm. And so I think this comes up for, you know, there's always like, is it a soft landing, hard landing, an L-shaped recovery or whatever? Maybe it's a K-shaped recovery where parts, you know, some parts are doing okay and other parts are hurting as though it was a recession.
And that kind of leads me, let's talk about the housing market here for a minute. Do you think, what are your thoughts on the housing market here and how does that fit into the business cycle? As we know, you know, it's very tight, but for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, it's tight because of all the supply issues. There's a ton of people who need homes who are priced out. The affordability is just gone, right? So you very much do need rates to come down to be supportive of the housing sector. When we talk about the excess fiscal spending, the $7 trillion, right, and it's a litany of things and programs and whatever that happened, and I'm not even talking about the monetary support that happened earlier. The CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act really went right at non-residential construction. And so even when some of the residential construction started to ease up earlier, all the non-residential construction stuff was heating up quite well toward the end of 22 into 23. And so we've had that tug of war against the cyclical impulses that are there. But I don't think we're at a stage at the moment where housing can really power a recovery. We have a lot more to go through before that can happen. And so rents remain high, which supports inflation. You know, it keeps it from going really low.
I think the affordability issue is key because, as Lachman pointed out, there's a lot of people who would like to buy a house. They simply can't afford it. And that there's two reasons for that. Home prices went up so much. And obviously, mortgage rates are somewhat prohibitive. Rents have gone up, which makes it tougher for people to save for that down payment. Back in 2007, one of the charts I showed was looking at housing prices relative to median incomes. And from 1965 to about 2001 or so, the ratio was between 2.8 and 3.2. I mean, it was really kind of amazingly consistent. And the reason was that banks limited mortgage payments to about one third of a person's income. And my take in looking at that ratio had gone from around three to 4.5. And I said, you know, it's just basically that opens the door for housing prices to drop back down to that long-term average, which implied a 20 to 25% decline in home prices. And we have something similar playing out again, is that the average home price is way beyond the means of a lot of the people who would like to buy. We have baby boomers who are sitting in big houses, A, because they have an unbelievably low mortgage rate, but housing prices continue to creep higher. So there's no incentive whatsoever for those people to seriously consider downsizing. And I think potentially the issue will be as we get into next year, again, I think next year the economy is going to be far weaker. We'll see housing prices start to come down. And as the economy weakens, you'll see unemployment go up. So there's been no forced selling because the unemployment rate's near a 50-year low. So I think there's a combination of things that could come into play here, Tracy, as we get into next year, where supply starts to pick up, for a number of different reasons. And yeah, mortgage rates are going to come down, but I'm not sure that will be enough to offset what we need to see happen. And that is housing prices have to come down measurably so that more people can afford to buy one. And that to me is what's going to play out over the next 1 to 3 years. Housing prices are going to drop by 10% or 15 or 20? Obviously, it depends on what marketplace you happen to be in. But I think that is important because if housing prices decline, net worth of consumers takes a hit. If the equity market suffers a meaningful decline at any point in time, net worth takes a hit. So one of the things that I think has been helping the economy over the last 12, 18 months is the appreciation in asset values, increase in net worth, which has given people the capacity at the upper 50% to be able to keep spending money. And as Lakshman pointed out, I think very correctly, their stress is building underneath the surface that are working their way up as excess savings get run down. We're seeing the delinquencies in credit cards and auto loans picking up. So to me, this is a slow motion. Maybe train wreck would be too strong of a word, but I do think that at the point in time the economy enters a recession, more of these stresses are going to be amplified and result in less spending in a weaker economy, especially as we get into next year.
Did you have anything to add to that, Lakshman?
Yeah. I think if we talk about next year, I have to wait to see where the leading indexes go because I just don't want to predict where they're going to head. But that's certainly possible. I would not push back on what Jim has said here. I just was thinking as I was listening to what he was saying, though, that kind of what's the catalyst? You know, what is it that does it? Is it, what are we suspicious of? And the indicators are forward looking indicators are telling us really clear, like global industrial upturn. So I don't know how that manifests in the market narrative. Is it priced? Isn't it priced? At some point when some of the industrial commodity prices continue to move up, what does that do to the way people think about things? Does that in some way merge with sticky inflation talk and become part of that narrative? I think institutionally, for whatever reasons, the Fed wants to keep the rate cut stuff alive in 2024. And if for nothing else, for the commercial real estate sector, which is going to, as we've been talking, is going to be under increasing pressure. And also the bottom half of consumers who have a lot of debt or interest rate exposure. So I'm looking for the catalysts, and I'm looking for the divergences to borrow another word from Jim. And it's this risk of the inflation cycle upturn and definitely the global industrial upturn that seem like things that have diverged in some ways from the overall market story. And that's the place where maybe somebody gets surprised.
And then I want to turn to USD here for a minute. Jim, how is this impacting the markets right now? And are you looking for higher or lower over the next few months? I know that, we saw a dip in the dollar when people went crazy and factored in 6 rate cuts in the market. And we've seen a significant upturn in the dollar now that the chance of rate cuts have gone down to 1.5 perhaps. So what are your thoughts on, the longer term on USD right now?
Yeah. As you noted, coming into this year, people are looking for sit rate cuts. And I thought that was kind of not going to happen. To me, the pattern of the dollar suggested a rally. It was trading around 100 at the time. Rallied up to 107, I think 34. We had a pullback. I thought the dollar would rally on the hotter than expected CPI report. To me, that 107.34 is a key level. My bias has been is that we would not get above that. That you get this bounce, and then we'll see the dollar weaken and drop below 100 at some point in time in 2024. Again, that's predicated on the idea that the economy is going to show more signs of slowing. So the dollar has rallied since late December on the idea that, well, wait a second, the economy is doing good, as Lakshman has, noted very precisely. Things show signs of picking up. If that continues and the dollar gets above 107.34, I think that's problematic for the markets. So that to me is a key number that, the high that we saw in recent weeks. Again, my expectation is that we had a pullback from that number. We're getting a bounce. The 106.50 to 107 was a target area. We're getting near that. But again, it's going to be predicated on the idea that things start to show signs of slowing.
Did you have any thoughts on that?
I've learned enough to not predict FX rates, but I would say when we look at growth and inflation, looking at it from that point of view, it's, we all applaud the Bank of Japan for doing a tiny rate hike after 17 years. But the problem is, right, all that debt, which we started the call off with when we were talking at the beginning of the spaces, all that government debt, that whole policy of like, we're just going to have a lot of debt in order to get some growth. And they're at the point where they can't really raise rates a lot over there because of financing their government debt. It'll probably pull a lot of capital back home. But I don't think they could really raise rates that much. So that's probably supportive for the dollar. In Europe, they don't really know it, but they're going to have some inflation stuff to deal with as the year progresses. So even though they're looking backwards at a few recessions here and there or some near misses, and they also very much want to cut, they may not be able to do it quite as much. And then it all becomes this kind of game of relative cut or hike expectations. And if the future inflation gauge goes up and the Fed's wiggle room gets really tight, that could be more supportive for the dollar. But maybe the move happened already. I'm not sure.
And how far does Japan let the yen depreciate?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one, right? Because it's like, careful what you wish for. They got some inflation. It's been so long that they're like, what is this thing? We don't know what it is. But they have an inflation cycle upturn. And for the time being, they're also gearing off of the global industrial upturn. So they've got a little action there on the economy side. And that's a new thing in a way for them. New in the sense it's been almost well over a decade, almost two decades since they've had that kind of thing to deal with. And my guess is they'll try to thread the needle. Lots of jawboning, a little bit of movement here and there, but relative to the U.S., I think they'll probably move much more gingerly. Which means it's not that supportive for the yen.
Just as an aside, I think if I'm the Bank of Japan and looking and hearing about the focus at the 152 level, Tracy, and the expectation that, gee whiz, the Bank of Japan is going to come in to defend that, I just thought that was a faulty notion. I thought that the Bank of Japan would allow the yen to break that 152 level, get that next, if you will, potentially final period of weakness, and then that it would potentially increase the meaningfulness of any kind of intervention after allowing it to take out that 152. One thing that I use, which is pretty helpful, is looking at whatever the price is that one is looking at, a 5 and 13 period exponential moving averages. And when the 5 crosses below the 13, it's kind of like, okay, trends down. And when it crosses above the 13, trends up. So as a contrarian, I'm looking for a low in the yen, but we need obviously confirmation from a price standpoint that that in fact is what's really taking place. Mm-hmm. And again, if the dollar weakens because the economy starts to slow, or people start to think, you know, higher for longer isn't really going to be good for U.S. growth. That's how I think the dollar can weaken initially. But the point being is, if that evolves and the dollar begins to roll over and heads, as I said, I think below 100 in this year, you know, that would be obviously supportive for the yen. So I'm looking for the yen to make a low, but you want the price confirmation before one sticks one's neck out. Hmm.
Makes sense. And then before we, I know we're coming up on the hour, but I just want to hit on gold here really quickly before we go to the final round of questions. As far as gold is concerned, we've seen gold, you know, ratcheting up fresh records against the headwinds of a stronger dollar, 70 basis point jump in the 10-year treasury yield, and kind of a hawkish shift talk from the Federal Reserve. So, and this mix will normally spell trouble for gold. So, you know, what is different this time? And I know that the big narrative is it's all China buying, but I just don't buy that.
Yeah. Mm. Well, my take was, coming into this year that we were going to see gold rally above 2300 at some point in time. And that was predicated, Tracy, on that from the low last year, I think it was around 1810. That gold had rallied in five waves up until the high in May of last year. So again, that five-way rally, from my interpretation, meant that the longer-term trend had turned positive. But that five-wave up also meant that we were at a high last May. We were going to see a pullback for wave two, which we did see. And then that would, in February, I suggested, hey, I think gold's ready to go. And so we broke out, ran above 2,400. I think we're going to see a pullback, but I think gold is headed higher. And again, to me, the technical aspect suggests, it kind of confirms the idea that potentially the dollar is going to roll over, because the chart pattern in gold, I think, is very constructive longer term. Well, what would really be a tailwind? It would be dollar weakness. And to your point is, despite higher rates, despite the rebound we've seen in the dollar, gold has been showing that it can make a move without having those two factors as a tailwind. Well, if and when the dollar weakens and treasury yields come down again, I would think that is why gold can make another, you know, significant move to the upside. Just short term, I think a pullback toward the 2200 level is probably likely.
And last, your thoughts on gold, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think longer term, it's hard to miss the elephant in the room, which is deficit spending everywhere, pretty much. And with rates as high as they are in the U.S., that becomes significant drain on the budget. So that's a kind of a structural deficits are going to be supportive. But then on the cyclical basis, the U.S., I'm saying we've got to see the future inflation gauge turn up first, and I'm very suspicious of that. But internationally, we don't have to wait. It's already happening. And so on a cyclical basis, as an inflation hedge, I think, you know, gold can play some role in that.
Excellent. All right. So now it's the final round. And it's the same question for both of you. We'll start with Lakshman. First, what you can either talk about something that you wanted to touch upon that we didn't get to touch upon that you think is very important for our audience to know, and or what should we be really focused on, you know, over, say, the next, you know, 12 to 36 months?
Okay, so real quick, China is still, because we have indicators on China, China's still messy, but their goods sector, the international, the trade sector is gearing nicely, and it'll continue to gear. And so that's about 20% of their economy. That's very different from the beginning of 2023 when everybody thought, hey, China's going to run because they reopened and our indicators were dead flat. They weren't going up. So that's one thing to note. The other thing to note, I think, is that, you know, embedded in this immaculate disinflations kind of narrative, where you could have inflation behave without having a recession kill it, is this idea that somehow productivity growth is going to has roared back and will continue to roar back. And that just doesn't add up when we look at our cyclical research. And with all of the different things that kind of ail the economy, that's the way out, is by saying productivity growth is going to come back really well. And for a whole host of reasons, we could just be snapping back from really super depressed lows post-COVID. And it may be nothing more than just a statistical mathematical move back and not sustainable for in the coming months or year or so.
So am I to understand that you don't think that China's really on the verge of a collapse and about to, you know, send, you know, deflation across the world?
Well, oh, no, hang on. I think the one part of their economy that's working is the industrial sector, where they can make stuff and send it out. And so I think, yeah, they're going to do that. Probably their currency, they're happy for it to be weaker too. So yeah, they're going to start to do that. It's just that the supply chains, it's not set up the same way it was post GFC. It's different now. I think even on both sides of the aisle, we're talking about tariffs at this point, right? So you've got, and you know, we didn't even talk about geopolitical stuff, but maybe some of that comes into your economic policy, right? So I think China has to push on the thing that's working for them, which is their industrial base and the ability to export. So they're going to push on it. And to a degree, that'll give us some disinflation on goods, maybe in 6 months or a year. That's not going to change what the future inflation gauge is doing in the next few months, or the Fed trying to hang on to its narrative of we're cutting into the fall. That's where I think it can get a little dicey over the summer.
Thanks. And then, Jim, same question. You could talk about something that you didn't get a chance to talk about that you think is important, and or what should we be particularly focused on over the next, you know, 12 to 36 months?
Sure. Well, this is a little bit longer than that, but I think it's really kind of important. And that is that over the last 50, 60 years, the combination of fiscal policy and monetary policy has been implemented to manage the business cycle. And historically, it meant deficit spending. It meant the Fed cutting interest rates. But if you look underneath the surface, in the 1960s, each new dollar of debt generated about 90 cents of GDP. Last year, the deficit was 6% of GDP, and GDP grew 3%. So obviously, the impact from adding more and more debt is being diluted. Secondly, monetary policy. If you go back to the last 50, 60 years or more, you'll see that the Fed consistently kept the funds rate above the rate of inflation. Starting in about 2001, the funds rate was brought down below the rate of inflation. So historically, the Fed could regulate the level of real rates to either increase economic activity or decrease. Now we got to a point where, we need to cut to, so that we have a negative cost of money. Then after the great financial crisis in 2008, the Fed expanded its balance sheet. And so my point being is the effectiveness of monetary policy, looking out over the last 60, 70 years, also seems diluted. So if I'm right that we are on the cusp of a secular bear market in bonds, a secular bear market in stocks, these two reasons, I think, are going to play a role in that, yes, well, if we have a recession, is Congress going to spend a lot of money? Absolutely. Will the Fed cut rates? Yes. But the effectiveness over many decades has been dwindling. And therefore, those policy tools aren't likely to be as effective. And to me, that sets the stage for an extended period of lower economic growth. And given the social divisiveness that we see politically in this country, weaker economic growth is only going to cause more tension and anger. So, you know, when I look out, that to me is what's coming. And, you know, I think most people just haven't considered and looked at it over a multi-decade period. But I think the influence is going to be pretty significant in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
And on that uplifting note.
But, you know, if you see it coming, you'd like to think you might be able to duck. And so to me, that's the important thing and why I really try to incorporate a lot of technical analysis is that we're going to see swings that are going to be fairly significant. Just like from 66 to 82, the Dow went from 1,066 to 882. But there were big swings to try to capitalize that sideways period. And I just think that that's what most investors are lacking, but what is going to be necessary to navigate this.
Excellent. And with that, thank you, gentlemen, for spending your time with us today. I really appreciate it. Follow these guys on Twitter and go check out all of the stuff that they have to offer on their websites. And with that, again, thank you so much. I know that our audience thanks you so much. And with that, I will see everybody next Wednesday. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy. Nice chatting with you, Lakshman.
You too, Jim. Have a good afternoon.
You too.